Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy any investment based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Hello and welcome to the Sunday Roast. It's Sunday the 7th of December. I'm Phil Carroll.
And I'm Kevin Hornsby.
What a week, Kev. How's things? You visited the UK. How was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, I was in the UK. I can predict, or not predict, I can state that the weather is horrible. And it wasn't even that horrible, but in comparison, it was horrible, and I didn't like it.
Okay. I mean, it's wet, isn't it? It's kind of, the odd day comes through and we get a bit of sunshine, which is like the sun's coming in now, it's blue skies. But then, yeah, the wet days are kind of like outnumbering the dry days at the moment.
When I arrived in Manchester.
Yeah, but mate, that's Manchester. It's the rainiest city in
no,
the UK.
Honestly, I felt like I'd sort of fallen into hell in terms of the weather. It was grey. It was pouring down rain. It was miserable. But anyway, and then I got to London and I fell down the stairs in the hotel. So,
let this be a lesson to anybody who is attached, surgically attached to the mobile phone. When you're walking downstairs, please look up away from your screen, watch your footing, because if you don't, you'll end up falling down the last three stairs.
I can concur with that advice. That's good advice. Don't walk down the stairs reading your phone, but we all do, unfortunately. So I was.
And
supposed
how is it
to,
now? Is it recovered? Have you rested it? Have you got any ice on it?
It's rested it. It's just all bruised, but it's not really hurting very much now. So I think I just strained my tendons. And So I was walking down the stairs basically to go meet our guest today and a few others. And then the next day I was supposed to be going to Resourcing tomorrow. So a big shout out to First Class Metals, who I was supposed to be going to see them and a few others at Resourcing tomorrow. And I didn't make it because I couldn't walk, basically. Couldn't hobble.
Yeah,
so
good.
I got a taxi straight to the next place I had to go to, and that was it. So yeah, I mean, I also actually, interestingly, when we're talking about First Class Metals, I'll talk about this at the end a bit more, but I also had a good chat with the Valerium guy, Gary, during the week, and obviously they're working together. So we'll talk about that at the end anyway. But yeah, what's been happening in the world?
Well, not a lot, really, and it was not going to be a massive amount of chat about this, but the biggest story I could find, really, was the negotiations being held in Moscow between Russia and US. Obviously, we saw Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner in attendance in Moscow. It ended without a deal, with Russia rejecting key parts of the proposals, keeping core territorial demands intact. I think we're going to have a stalemate. I mean, Putin has just reaffirmed that Russia intends to take full control of the eastern Donbass region by military means or otherwise, making it very clear that these territorial concessions are non-negotiable. And obviously, Kiev has reiterated it wants real peace, not appeasement, and rejected any deal as well that compromises Ukraine's sovereignty or cedes territory under pressure. So, you know, diplomacy continues with the US pushing this revised peace framework, but the gap remains wide, Kevin. Putin and the Kremlin remain committed to this, you know, keeping these territorial aims. And obviously, Ukraine continues to resist concessions. So what can you do? You're in a stalemate situation.
And Putin really has pulled out the European Union big style, hasn't it? From what I read, I don't know for sure that was factual, but he basically was saying, you boys are trying not to make or allow this to happen. And I mean, Russia, in inverted commas, has won the war. And the Europeans are trying to make it look like they haven't. And ultimately, you know, he's basically saying, no chance. This is what's happening. If you want to do it, carry on. If you don't, we'll carry on and we'll kill another load of people. It's just absolutely ridiculous.
I think there was a really interesting article I read in The Eye this week, and it was saying that one guy was saying, he was an envoy to Russia at some point, but basically he was saying that a lot of the past Russian governments and leaders have fallen over the years, you know, like the Gorbachev and the likes. And he was saying, is it a matter of time before, as the Russian economy weakens and people are being punished, like there's big recession over, it's only a matter of time before a recession hits. Everything's gone up in cost, you know, obviously with all the export bans or exports from a lot of the companies, and a lot of companies pulling out. The Russians have had it very difficult for the last 4 or 5 years, and obviously they're seeing how, what did you say, was it like 1.2 million Russians have died in the Ukraine conflict? I mean, at what point do the people rise up and you know, overthrow Putin, or if Putin's just removed, because it's not helping the economy. And people, regardless of what you think, want to live with a comfortable life, don't they, Kev? You know, not punished.
Yeah, no, they do, but the concept of overthrowing a government in the in Russia is not as quite as simple as well, we need a government overthrown, but it's not Russia, it's the
I don't,
United
I'm not
Kingdom.
necessarily like a coup, but more of just a removal of Putin as he
Yeah,
continues to push
don't
them
see
into
it. Just do not see it, to be honest with you. We
No.
do need it. We need it, as I said to you just now, we need a removal of a government, but it isn't in Russia.
Yeah. Did you see that Reeves as well talking about the government moving to UK? Rachel Reeves has been under a bit of spotlight. She claims she was a British under 14 chess champion, but it turns out that that claim was disputed, and she did win a different girls' championship, but a very local one, but not the official one she implied. And then obviously we saw the head of the OBR, the Office for Budget Responsibility, Richard Hughes, resigning in the week after the budget analysis was leaked early due to some technical glitches. So he obviously did fall on the sword. It was only a matter of time, we did say,
Yeah.
but heads rolled.
I think Rachel told him you're falling on the sword because I'm not.
Yeah.
Rachel from accounts. Yeah, I mean, it's just a comedy show, isn't it? You know, and when I was in England, you know, so many people are just like, what's the point? It's depressing. This whole thing is like crazy. And many people talking about, you know, where's the best place to move to? You know, if you're an entrepreneur, yeah, to not be in the UK. And that even if only a very tiny percentage of those people go, that is going to take from the top and mean that there'll be less taxation coming. I was talking with somebody during the week there about the Laffer curve, and we're on it. We're on the downside of it. I'm sure of it. We're on the downside of the Laffer curve, and the Laffer curve basically explains that the higher the taxation is, the less the take is that you get ultimately in the United Kingdom. That's where we're at. We're on the Laffer curve. We're on the top of it on the basis that if you ask for more now, you're going to get less.
And you kill growth effectively, don't you? You
You've
completely
already
smash.
killed growth, but now you're going to get less taxation because, one, there is no growth, and two, people are voting with their feet. And the thing is, the Laffer curve was also created at a time where it wasn't as easy to move as it is now. So you could probably argue that the Laffer curve actually has probably changed as well and become much more dramatic than it used to be.
Okay, well, let's move on to our guest this week. We're delighted to be joined by Michael Jones, CEO of Delta Gold Technologies, recently listed on the Aquis Exchange under the ticker DGQ. So, welcome, Michael. How's life?
Yeah, great. Thanks. Very exciting week. Thank you.
Absolutely. So we saw the news that Delta Gold Technologies is a newly listed quantum technology company focused on developing intellectual property and materials science innovations for the next generation of quantum computing hardware. They just completed their admission to Aquis, raising £2.5 million through a placing of 25 million shares at 10 pence, and are now pushing forward with work centered around quantum devices, gold-based nanostructures, and qubit-level materials engineering. Today, we're diving into what Delta Gold is building, why gold is an important material in quantum hardware, and what a qubit actually is, and how their technology aims to make quantum computing more stable, more scalable, and more commercially realistic. So, Michael, firstly, congratulations on your Aquis listing. Can you give us a short version of what Delta Gold Technologies actually does?
I think you've done an excellent job, actually. You've said it very well. But you know, I think what's interesting is in the market around quantum computing, you have companies carrying, you know, $10 billion, $20 billion market caps. And you know, there's certainly a long way down the trail in their particular physical creation of a qubit. And I'll describe what a qubit is in a minute. But you know, it's very interesting that we're at a stage where multiple major companies are pursuing their own particular piece of physics to create this thing, a qubit. And just the fact that the major companies are in different materials, different ways of doing it, shows that the physics is not settled. And we actually stumbled across something that was quite unique. It's in one of the major zones of creating a qubit, but it's a very unique way of doing it. And it turns out that gold and some other materials combined have a very interesting property. And we discovered this kind of by accident a couple of years ago. And we've put together this company around that sort of fundamental discovery. So that's where we come from. And our goal is to create innovation in creating a stable qubit. So just to describe what a qubit is, most people know what a bit is. It's a zero or a one. And if you get 8 bits, you get a byte. And, you know, megabytes, people have all heard of that. So that's a certain number of zeros and ones. A qubit is quite interesting in that it can be a zero and it can be a one, or it can be something in between at the same time. Now, that's a little hard to gather because it's in quantum physics world, but it's been shown to be true. And people are actually running experiments and working with qubits. And it gives the computer an enormous amount more power because it's got an infinite, much greater number of ways of looking at data. So that's kind of the fundamentals of what a qubit is. And we're looking to create one that's stable and you can scale, as you mentioned. That's really the holy grail of quantum computing.
Yeah, I think I heard you reference it almost like a dimmer switch on. You've got a zero, which is off, and a one, that's the light being turned on. But the dimmer switch allows you to turn the levels of intensity up and brightness sliding from zero to one. I guess if you look at, I remember from computing science, like you have your binary digits all laid out, you know, starting at 1, 2, 4, 8, 16 going up. And I think there's like in an 8-bit computer or 8-bit system, there's like 65,536 different. So presumably, when you have these qubits, you have almost an infinite amount of different optionalities there.
Yeah, and I like your sliding dimmer switch analogy, but it's missing a dimension, really, in that it's more like you can point upwards or you can point down or you can point in any which way you want to in three-dimensional space. And it's even more than that because it's not confined by three dimensions, but that begins to give you the idea of the different possibilities to be able to hold and compare information. And it's actually comparing two of the states that gives the quantum computing its power.
So what are the challenges of getting these qubits, like making them sort of useful within, you know, computing? And obviously, as demand increases for things like AI itself and data centers, the gold element of things, you know, when we say to gold, we think of obviously aesthetics of a metal there, a precious metal, and also mining. But your company is about this nano gold technology. And what makes gold such a powerful material for quantum hardware?
Well, I can't answer that question directly for two reasons. The first one is I'm not a quantum physicist, so I won't do a good job. And the second of all is if I could do a good job, I couldn't tell you because it's intellectual property. So it's actually rather useful that I don't know because, you know, I don't want to give away the secret. I don't fully understand the secret, to be perfectly honest with you. I mean, this is a very highly technical space. And that's one of the powers that the company has, is that we're working with University of Toronto and one of the top people in the world who's done a postdoctoral fellowship from MIT at IBM, one of the great investors in quantum. So we have one of the top people in the world, Professor Harry Ruda, as our principal investigator. So, you know, the technical end is very well looked after, that's for sure. But, you know, to answer your question, I'll tell you the quick little story of how we fell onto this. So I read weird technical papers, and I found that nanoparticle gold was doing something strange. It was acting as an extreme catalyst. We know that gold's a catalyst, that's normal. But it was acting much more than just the increase of surface area in nanoparticles. It was doing something very odd. So I eventually got up the courage to go back to my old university. My family's had people at University of Toronto for 120 years, actually, four generations. So I have a connection with University of Toronto. And I went to the head of nanoparticle physics at University of Toronto and showed him this paper and said, why is it doing this? Because the paper didn't say. And he said, I don't know, but it's very interesting. And I didn't hear from him for 3 months. I thought he'd gone away, actually. And 3 months later, Professor Ruda came back to me and he said, I figured it out. And it's actually super interesting, but not for the reason that you asked. And it's because he was in quantum that the thing popped out. So that was the beginning of the establishment of the ideas around intellectual property and my acquiring the intellectual property from University of Toronto, which is now in Delta Gold Technologies. So there's a very special thing that gold does that other elements don't do. That's all I can tell you.
Okay, so taking that whatever it is you found, exploiting whether it's conductivity or stability or whatever it is, are you aiming at Delta Gold to manufacture quantum components, or are you aiming to license that IP to sort of larger hardware companies? What's the vision?
Yeah, so definitely our primary model is to license. I mean, I think we're going to have to manufacture a certain number of devices to be able to prove that our technique works, and how to manufacture those things, which is done in an extreme vacuum and very carefully with other materials. That's what we're working on right now. So we will have to demonstrate with a device per se. It's not just a theoretical calculation in the lab. So there's some pretty incredible equipment that you access with the partnership of University of Toronto, like a thing that can get you near absolute vacuum. And we also are installing in a new part of the lab, our part of the lab, something that gets you to near absolute zero temperature wise, because you don't want outside energy interfering with your experiments. So they take this down to actually within a half a degree of absolute zero, minus 470 degrees. That's not your average university bar fridge, that's for sure. So it's quite a thing to be able to do these things. Not everybody can do it, but the one thing I say is that we've got technical people, and through the university, access to electron microprobes, absolute vacuums. We've got a whole kit of engineering materials and capability that it's very difficult to replicate. So yeah, it's very interesting.
Very good. And then moving on, the last question for me is, who are your potential commercial partners? You mentioned universities there, obviously,
Universities
both
there.
chip makers, government labs. Who would you be targeting?
Well, that's the amazing thing about quantum, right? Is that this is going to change everything. I mean, it goes from fundamental science, computers, to banking, to investment models, to the military, to climate modeling, to bioscience, to large data storage. And one of the big powerful things that's happening with the world is AI, and the ability to marry AI to a supercomputer is really, I mean, some people have called quantum computing is the most powerful thing since the man discovered fire. I mean, it really is that fundamental. And so the licensing capabilities to be at the forefront of the science here is completely enormous. And I've always thought, stay open-minded, find where the best value is. That's really our strategy.
Yep. So, Michael, you sort of glazed over the fact that when we were having a drink in the pub on Monday night after the first day of trading in DGT, that one of the things you like to do is read these professional PhD papers, if you like. So tell the world that you're a bit weird in terms of all the other people in the world, and how this story really came about, in terms of going back. I mean, you did brush on it there, but let's go back to the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, so yeah, I'm an engineer by background. I was brought up by a professor, so I've sort of been around universities and technical matters and academic member matters my whole life. And I just want to keep my mind active, and so I get a regular stream of academic papers in subject areas I'm interested in. And one of the areas I'm interested in is precious metals. I've built gold mines, I've built platinum mines, I've found mines that find these metals before in my life as an engineer. And so I'm always interested in what they do technologically. And precious metals are very special. We know that intuitively, but they actually do unique things on the periodic table. And I founded a company in a joint venture with Anglo American to put platinum and palladium in a lithium battery. And we did work at Florida International University. And this was another story exactly like Delta Gold. I was sitting at home, I'd read this paper. I got enough courage up to contact the scientist that wrote the paper, who was ex-MIT as well. Somehow both these stories have a connection to MIT, which is coincidental. But he was very receptive to my call, and I flew down to Florida International University and acquired the 100% of the intellectual property rights to that innovation. And that became a 7-year research project that filed a whole series of patents that are actually in commercialization in the battery world. So I've done this before. I understand the power of a research sponsorship agreement, the amount of effective research you can get done with all the tools of the university around you, and that you can actually acquire 100% of the intellectual property rights. And that's what I did with this idea, and University of Toronto followed exactly the same roadmap. The precedent agreement I had in Toronto is very similar to the one I had before, although it's in the Canadian context. And so, yeah, I've learned that lesson that there is great, efficient, top of the world best minds in the world work that you can do collaborating with a university. I don't know why, you know, companies don't do it more. It's interesting. One of the top players in the space, Rigetti, which has something like a $17 billion market cap, just announced a collaboration with the University of Chicago. And it was kind of, that's just a couple of weeks ago. And it's fascinating to me that, you know, a company of that scale says it's material to them that they're going to work with University of Chicago. So, you know, we're already doing that with one of the top people in the world as Delta Gold Technologies, brand new out of the box. So I think there's a lot of horsepower to be utilized in a space where, as I said at the outset, the physics is not settled yet. You know, there is a scenario where people spending billions of dollars a year are going down dead end hallways. We might actually have the hallway with the door open at the end.
But this is an interesting part. I mean, I remember having this conversation with you 7-8 months ago, okay? Because, yes, you know, Oliver Friesen and you were sitting in a desk opposite each other because you're heavily involved with Guardian Metal Resources. So is Jamie, yes, Tosh, who we met during the week, and also Mark Burnett. So you're like, yes, the four horses of the apocalypse, but that's not a good idea. you have named yourself the Guardsman, and that's going to be a something that will maybe people will start to know as you do more things. But when I had this discussion with Oliver, and Oliver was like, "Well, we've got this idea," and it was like, "Okay, let's talk about the idea," and then you for me lit up the whole idea that this, even a small win in this particular situation, could be worth hundreds of millions, if not billions of pounds. So do you want to just put some context in that in terms of the current quantum computing companies, things that have happened in the UK recently, et cetera, et cetera?
Sure. I mean, it's interesting. This week, we've seen enormous moves in the quantum companies. So some of the top companies, you know, would be IonQ, D-Wave Quantum, and Rigetti as an example, and they're up between 12 to 28% this week, okay? And they carry billions of dollars of market cap. So there's definitely the recognition, I think, of what's going on in quantum is starting to happen. And interestingly, as I said at the beginning, IonQ, they're working in a different area of qubits than Rigetti, for example, and D-Wave actually is using classical computers alongside the unstable sort of qubit computer where it sits today. So there are various approaches to this business, which is demonstrated by these companies that we're watching move this week. Any kind of innovation in this space, which could open the right hallway and the right door at the end of the hallway, is worth a lot of money. And there's no better example than Oxford Ionics. So Oxford Ionics was looking particularly at electrons and how electrons are behaving around the superconducting aspect of qubits. And they developed some quite innovative tools. And that company was a 3-year research project at Oxford. And it was just bought as a private company for $1 billion US in cash, $1 billion. Wow. Three scientists at Oxford working on a fundamental aspect.
What's Delta Gold Technologies
market cap? £7 million.
Okay, so there's a slight discrepancy there in terms of what's going on.
Well, and I can tell you categorically that the horsepower of minds we have working on our stuff is every bit as good. I'd send those guys to war with Oxford any day. You know, I think it's interesting. One of the things that really convinced me that this belongs in a public company at this stage is that when we went out to, we funded privately. The first round of research, the first year of research was already paid before we came to list and the work started. And we went out to recruit some of the top scientists in the world from Pakistan, from Poland, from all over the world. And they brought technical papers to our principal investigators of things that they were working on and how they could contribute to the project technically. I'll be honest with you, I didn't understand the cover slide, okay? Like, the presentations were so technical, I had no idea what they were talking about. I admit it. However, they were taught by their resumes. You can see they're top people in quantum in the world, quantum physics. And they wanted to come to Toronto and move their families from around the world to join this project. And it's because under NDA, we were able to show them a little bit of the fundamentals of the idea. And of course, Professor Ruda has 14 patents to his name. He's cited in the academic literature 2,800 times. So and it's very important for a PhD that wants to continue their education. They want to work on their postdoctoral fellowship under one of the top people in the world. That's how it works.
Yeah.
And God bless these folks. They're not motivated by stock options or making money or whatever. They love the physics and they want to work with the top people in the world. So this is great. And that's what's happening.
Okay, so I think when we were having a chat on Monday, we discussed that we'll try and get Professor Ruda on at some point to totally confuse us. I mean, at times you're confusing me, so I'm quite sure Professor Ruda will. But I'm intrigued. I know you sort of covered it with Phil in terms of the qubit. What is a qubit in comparison to a chip that's in a normal computer? Like, I mean, are we talking about the chip when we're talking about a qubit?
So the first thing maybe, well, as we described the fundamental aspects of it, but it's this multidimensional ability to be more than one thing at one time and to have much more possibilities. That's where the power of the computer comes from, is that it's not just a zero or a one. And to be able to compare qubits gives you this ability to say, you know, to handle information. So the software area, or the middleware where you actually manage these qubits and use them for calculations, is a whole subject matter unto itself. It's very complicated. But there is a fundamental aspect here that these things are just carrying more information available to be compared and calculated with. I think that's the fundamental thing. And it's quite interesting that when we talk about a quantum computer, and I think investors will be quite confused by the fact that a number of companies have announced the creation of a quantum computer and calculations that are enormously fast. So they talk about calculations that can be done on an extremely complex problem that would take, one of the experiments was 5 minutes for the quantum computer would take something like a septillion years for a conventional computer to do. Like, we're talking about 10 to the 20 times more powerful. It's that level, okay? Mm-hmm. So the ability to do calculations is beyond your wildest imagination, frankly. And they've done experiments that show that. The problem is, and here's the thing for investors to understand, is that the quantum advantage, they call it, is the ability for a quantum computer to not only do a calculation, but do it reliably. And quantum computers, the best ones in the world, are somewhere around 0.00015% error rate, four zeros. So that's somewhere around 6.7 million calculations, you get an error. Sounds pretty good. The thing is, the computer you and I are talking on right now does that billions of times better,
yeah,
in terms of reliability. So there, now you're starting to get an idea. Yes, there are quantum computers. Yes, they can do calculations, but their physical format is not that practical because a lot of the work is done at near absolute zero, which is tricky. Like I said, more than your university bar fridge to handle that thing. But more importantly, actually, on the fundamental side, the error rate is just not there yet. And so there's a whole bunch of different approaches using multiple qubits to compare them to be able to take out the error rate by calculation. It's very complicated. But the fundamental physical attribute is you want a stable, scalable qubit. And by the way, when we say scalable, you know, we talk about a computer that has so many gigabytes of RAM. Something in the order of 100 qubits is lots. 1,000 qubits is an enormous amount of qubits in terms of the power. So you could end up with a way more than a supercomputer with just 10 qubits, but making those 10 qubits to be able to be scaled bigger and also stable, that's the essence of the business. That's where the cutting edge of the physics is.
Am I right? I'm trying to give this the dumbed down version. The computers that we deal with, it's like in two-dimensional world, whereas this is becoming a three-dimensional world.
It's more than that. It's multi-dimensional world.
Okay, so it's
Okay,
four
Kev,
dimensional,
think of
five
the
dimensional.
binary digit, the bit, as it's the smallest unit of data in computing, and you only have two possible values exactly, which is a zero or a
Zero,
one,
one, yeah.
which is either an on or an off, or a false or a true, or a low or a high state. Whereas the qubit is the quantum version of a bit, but it's got a special twist because you can either be a zero or a one or both at the same time. And this is
That's
the
it.
fact that it can be multiple states at once, which they refer to, I think, is it called a superposition or something? And that's why
That's
the
right.
computer can process everything much, much quicker. But as Michael says, the problem or the challenge that they've got at the moment is that the error rate is much higher in the qubit computers. And I guess I'm hoping that you're going to say that where Delta Gold comes in is that they're going to increase the performance, they're going to, reduce the error rate and make it almost perfect example of quantum computing, really, is my.
Well, our goal is to create a stable qubit, so one that through its very creation at the fundamental physics level is stable. And the particular when you read, and I'm not going to say what it is, but when you read about the zone of physics that we're working in, they say that it is one of the most, the words they use are kind of interesting, one of the most elegant solutions with the greatest potential. So it's that zone that we're working in. And it's like most things, you need that almost accidental eureka moment to discover the hallway that's got the open door at the end. I mean, and you can spend a long time down a lot of dead-end hallways trying keys and doors, and all of a sudden you find another hallway and the door's open at the far end. That's the kind of thing we're working on, honestly. And we also, I didn't talk about it, but actually we're
Sorry, go
also
on.
looking to look down more than one hallway. And what I mean by that is we think that with the academic power we have and the relationship with the university, we're actually already attracting other professors in other universities. So we think that as a thesis of growth and where the company's vision is, we want to create a center of excellence that actually brings together some of the brightest minds in the world. And we're already seeing that organically after trading for a week. We had one of the top physicists in Britain in here earlier this week. So we think that this idea of being a sponsor of a center of excellence in this and putting the brightest minds in the world together is actually super powerful. And there's traction on that. That there's interest in that. That's unique.
Yeah, I mean, somebody, even if you don't find a single diddly-doo-dot, if you actually have the brightest minds together and the potential that you get all the IP, some of these companies are going to pay a lot of money for this because something will come out of it,
You know, it's the I mean, think about the insurance value, as I call it. Like if you're spending, as the major companies are, spending $4 to $5 billion a year on research, and some little upstart company comes along and says, "Well, actually, maybe we've got a way that you haven't thought of." How much is that worth? I mean, how are you going to feel if you spent $4 billion for 5 years and somebody out of the box comes up with the keys to the kingdom, right?
Yeah. Well,
There's
I suppose the
a
good
fair amount
question.
of
Yeah. The
there's
good
a fair
question as
amount
the
of risk there.
CEO is if somebody came along to you now, right at the start of the story and said, here's 50 million pounds, we're taking it all, would you accept it?
I'm not today, no, but it would be a beginning of an interesting conversation.
Yeah. Okay. So the question, if we go back to what was said in the prospectus and the different things. Tell us just a little bit without giving too much away, because I know you can't, and maybe you're not like right at the. There's more a question for Professor Ruder. What does the nano state of gold do for the stability of the qubit?
Yeah, well, he'll tell you less than I will. I can tell you that for sure because I've been on calls with him and he's very cagey about it. And so, I mean, we know certain things about gold, right, that we can talk about publicly. So, gold is a superconductor, so it's available in the superconducting world as a superconductor. It's valuable that way. And we know that, as I say, gold does unusual things in nanoparticles. It acts as a super catalyst, so it's very available for chemical reactions. And there's certain reasons for that, and that's where the fundamental part of the physics is. I mean, I know more than that, but I can't tell you more than that. There's a very particular thing that it does. It has a behavior that is sort of not inherently obvious that that is revealed by its catalytic properties, to be honest.
Reminds me of that. I could tell you, but I'll have to kill you, sort of.
There's a very particular thing. It really is a fluke discovery in a way, in that my oddball question from left field in the catalytic area knocked into, and I happened to call a guy by chance that his real specialty is actually postdoctoral fellowship in quantum computing. I just happened to call that person. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I'd called the best nanocatalyst guy in the world, he would have told me why, and that would have been the end of the conversation. But that's not who I phoned. And
I think that's one in several billion chance that that could have happened.
Yeah, but you know, you make your own luck, right? Like you got to be out there being inquisitive, and hey, this is like super fun, right? Like, I mean, to interact with, it was the same in the battery space with Professor El Zahab at Florida International University. I mean, he's one of the brightest battery science guys on earth. He did a postdoctoral fellowship at MIT on battery science. Talking to him is a joy. I mean, it was really fun. And I spent, you know, 5 years working with him in his lab with a team of really bright people. And so I, you know, enjoy that enjoyment of that intellectual exercise and trying to gather in an area of physics or chemistry that you don't understand. It's super fun. I mean, this is what I do for fun. So, you know, this opportunity is just, you know, it's enormously exciting, and what a great pleasure to work with brilliant people.
But one of the basic issues with quantum computing, as you said, is reliability. If they could get this reliability sorted out, then it would be a winner for everybody. Okay. But the reality of it is, if you can only create something that lasts literally microseconds or whatever the term is, and it has to effectively work at somewhere around absolute zero because the heat it produces just is horrendous, then if you solve any of those problems, it's going to be worth an absolute fortune.
Well, it's like being chased by a bear, right? I don't have to run faster than the bear. I just have to run faster than the other guys being chased by the bear.
Yeah, absolutely. I think any slight improvement is going to be worth a lot of money, and a hell of a lot more money than £7 million, that's for sure. What was it that made you think, okay, here we go, we can do this in Toronto University, and we can, you know, take it to the next level, as in become a listed company? I know you were sitting next to the desk of Oliver, and therefore you had conversations with Oliver and Jamie and Mark, but what put that all together and made you go, yeah, okay, let's do this?
Well, I mean, I think it's a global opportunity that requires the horsepower of being a public company. I mean, we do think we'll bring some enormous milestones here that will require more capital. We're not going to say that we're going to just work with the capital we've raised. I think this gives us an opportunity to make some milestones, to project the vision, grow the market cap so that we can efficiently grow the business. So I think, although it's early stage work, it's in a field that is moving extremely rapidly, and we want to be in a position to be able to, you know, put fuel on this and go. So I think we're in the right space at the right time, actually. I would say.
Yeah, no, I can see that. I mean, I think how much would you be worth if you're on the NASDAQ? That would be quite funny.
Well, yeah, I mean, that requires the whole SEC thing, which I've done several times before. I've listed two companies on the NYSE, so the public company aspect of it doesn't deter me at all. I think it's, you know, it's horses for the courses. Let's get going. And, you know, even the Aquis Exchange has a good relationship with OTC in the U.S., and I've been down that trail before, I think, three times now. So, yeah, getting a relationship in the U.S., I think, would be prudent for us and grow the business from there. I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, Aquis is kind of an interesting thing in a number of ways, just to talk about that for 2 seconds. I mean, what really impressed me about them is their bond trading platform in Europe, trading billions and billions of dollars of bonds every day. It's a very efficient market that they run and a very good platform technologically. And they've got this stock exchange license in the UK, but there is opportunity for them to actually grow the Aquis platform across Europe. And that would actually be the equivalent of going from a Canadian market into the full US market, but European. And I think if Aquis is successful in that, that's a very exciting place to be listed. I mean, if we were not only a UK stock, but a pan-European stock, I think that'd be very interesting very quickly. I mean, so that's a growth path I'm actually quite excited about. But it's a very well set up exchange, and the listing process was efficient, and they've been quite helpful in getting the word out, getting market makers onto the stock. So I think it's a great platform to grow from. And then the US market, definitely would be part of our plans.
Okay, so I'm going to give you a look forward statement then. You give us a view of where you see this is all going. I mean, within, let's say, 13 months, so the end of next year, do you envisage that you will have applied for some patents? Do you envisage that you will have more than just Toronto in this game in terms of the universities and the selection process of trying to get IP and quantum computing?
Sure. So yeah, we've got a pretty clear roadmap on that front. So in the next 6 months, we would like to sign additional universities to research sponsorship and intellectual property agreements. And we're already in the midst of those discussions in a number of places, actually. So that whole process was up and running even before we became public, even though we hadn't signed anything yet. But the initial contacts are all running in that regard. So I'm quite confident about, you know, in the next 6 months that we will be a broader portfolio of these initiatives, and that we'll actually have collaboration between universities and top professors, and the recognition that Delta is actually something quite different with some of the smartest minds in the world. In a one-year milestone, we look to file our provisional patent. So patents are either provisional or specific, and I've been through this area before. You never want to file your provisional until you're very close to filing specific. So the way it works is you can file a broad provisional patent, but it's quite easy to attack. And you want to be following that with your specific patents. It's almost like staking out a large area and then putting the key corner pegs in your idea with the specific patents. And that's how you defend the whole provisional patent, is it's very hard to get in there without interfering with the specific ones. So we will file our provisionals when we're good and ready. And in a few months following, we can start to file specific patents. And that timing of how you do that, I learned from actually one of the former patent attorneys for Motorola who helped me in the battery world. So we've got a roadmap for that. And the scientists are very aware of how to detail their discoveries and their document their work in such a way to support that patent program. So we would expect the initial patents, our target is to do that a year from now. And I think that'll be quite a substantial announcement, combined with, you know, in the next 3 to 6 months, bringing on the center of excellence concept to support those innovations. And, you know, that's where I expect in the space itself, we'll really start to get recognized.
Mm. You're going to have a busy time in the next while then, because you're helping Oliver get GMAT onto the New York Stock Exchange as well. Well,
that's mining engineering stuff. That's easy. The quantum stuff is hard work, but it's fine. I'm learning.
Very good. Very good. Well, any more questions, Phil?
Not really, but I guess in the tradition of this podcast, we are on the Sunday roast. So I will say, Michael, what is your traditional Sunday roast in the Jones household?
Actually, that's easy. A bone-in prime rib done medium rare, surrounded in rosemary with vegetables and potatoes, basted in the pan, and a creme fraîche.
Very nice.
Creme fraîche. No gravy there then?
Oh, yeah. Of course there's gravy. What a silly question.
And horseradish, do you go for the straight horseradish?
Oh, and I forgot a very important component, which my wife does better than anyone I know, is the Yorkshire pudding has to be absolutely perfect and very puffy.
Very puffy, so, yeah. Brilliant. Honed my skills on those over the years with the pot, and it's like, get the fat in as high and as long as possible before you put the batter in, and then blast it up to 250 degrees and then watch it rise. Plain flour, 150 grams, 150 ml of mixture of water and milk, and then a little bit of nutmeg in there for a bit of flavoring. Perfect.
But what about the horseradish?
We'll pose the question whether there's a better way to do it to the first quantum computer.
What about the horseradish? Is it blow your head off horseradish or creamed horseradish?
Oh, yeah. No. It's got to be blow your head off. Like, you need to have the electrical stimulation at the top of your brain right here. Then you know it's good stuff.
The inverse of brain freeze.
Yes, that thing.
I'm in disagreement. It has to be the cream stuff, and the other stuff is painful.
No, man, it's got to be the wasabi kick.
That's it. You put that stuff in the baby bottle. It's not for adults.
Okay, so the other question is, what's the best advice you've ever had? What's the best advice you've ever been given?
Stay true to yourself.
Good one. And what's the best advice you've ever given someone else?
Don't be an asshole.
Okay, that's very good as well. Okay. Okay.
You didn't brief me on those questions. So I would have been better. Those were all surprise questions. So
That's the whole point. We are the roast. We're roasting you. I think basically going forward, we look forward to speaking to you as developments occur. I would suggest everybody who wants to listen to these things start studying, because you're going to need to understand a little bit to get to the bottom of this. But there is some incredibly powerful minds going into this to try and produce something, in all honesty, that's going to be better than a human brain in the end. I mean, that's the whole point with AI, really.
Wow. Let's not go that far. There's still something unique that happens between the ears. So I'm still comfortable that human beings will control quantum computers and AI, not the other way around. I'm pretty relaxed about that. So, join us on the learning experience. We're happy to come back and learn alongside of us. I'm still learning, and I think that's one of the keys to being successful is always be learning, be a lifelong learner.
Every day is a school day, as they say. But we look forward to getting Professor Harry Ritter on maybe in the next week, 10 days. We said we were going to try and contact him and get him on and just give a general overview about quantum computing in general, so everybody can get a grasp of it and understand it.
Yeah, Harry's very good. The only thing I'll say is that he can give you the story. He gives you the beginning of the story at a level you can understand, but it always tips into like, okay, he's gone. Like, okay, I'm not that far yet, but that's fine. It's okay. He's a very gracious gentleman, which is important. So, and we will be. That's one of the things in the short term. We will be making some announcements about the formalization of the full team. So I think some of the backgrounds and the where they've come from and so on, as I was speaking about, I think that is going to make a few eyebrows go up of the people that are coming to work on this. This is not work for kids. This is serious stuff of bright people from, like I say, it will raise a few eyebrows, I promise
it's
you.
It's the full strength horseradish. I'm getting that.
Exactly.
Okay, well, on that note, we'll say, Michael Jones, CEO of Delta Gold Technologies, thanks very much for appearing on the podcast.
My pleasure. Great to be with you. Cheers.
Thanks, Michael.
Okay, let's move on to some of the movers and shakers of the week. The best mover of the week is AYM, Anglesey Mining, up some 230%. They had an RNS on Friday where they detailed that they'd agreed a major balance sheet restructuring with its largest shareholder and creditor, Kinnear Gold Minerals, eliminating around £4 million of debt by transferring its interest in Grangersburg Iron and Labrador Iron Mines, leaving only about £100,000 of debt related to Paris Mountain. Kinnear Gold will also invest £350,000 via non-voting exchangeable warrants priced from the upcoming five-day VWAP, supporting Anglesey's immediate liquidity, while the company prepares a share consolidation to enable future warrant exercises. So at that board, the board has said that the reset will allow Anglesey to focus entirely on advancing its 100% owned Paris Mountain VMS project. And as part of the agreement, veteran mining executive Brendan Cahill and Jim Williams will join the board as non-exec directors. So it does look like they've finally turned things around, addressed the debt issue there, and obviously focusing completely, Kev, on the 100% owned Paris Mountain project. 200% riser on Friday. What do you make of it? It's good to see these ones, isn't it?
Good to see. Where is the Paris project? I don't know much about them.
Well, it's at Anglesey, isn't it? It's on Wales.
And the VMS system is there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, that's going to be very interesting. Good for the UK as well. So, let's hope it all works out.
Yeah. And then the shaker of the week, the worst performer was Deltic Energy, down some 50%. They announced in the earlier in the week that the recommended cash acquisition, which was approved by shareholders in August 2025, had been delayed as the North Sea Transition Authority requested further information before approving the change of control of Deltic's UK exploration licenses. The parties must respond by the 22nd of December, so that they have extended the scheme long stop date from the 31st of December 25 to 31st of March 2026. And Deltic's board still believes that the deal is in shareholders' best interest, but is disappointed by the ongoing regulatory holdup, and further updates will follow. So, not great news, but are we surprised when the NSTA authority, extra approval, extra change of control for the licenses there? We've seen holdups with other companies. So, not a great performer, 50% down. General markets, Kev. FTSE 100 ended the week around modestly higher. I mean, closing around the 97.10 on Thursday. Anything else? Investor sentiment cautious, but what do you make of the broader UK market?
I genuinely think things are looking like they're improving a little bit. But yeah, let's see. Let's see if we get a Santa rolling. I'm still
Yeah.
hopeful that
I
we
don't know
will
if
get
you
a Santa
saw
rolling.
one interesting point of the last sort of 3, 4 weeks, where we've seen, as we keep saying, that we've had this kind of like a little bit of a switch in the market. It's almost a feel of a bearish feel. Did you see the article that Bloomberg put out that stated that Stifel, however you want to call it, one of the market makers, are going to cut the London-based equities trading staff in a UK pullback? And they're obviously shutting that UK equities trading desk. And I think that from what I'd seen in the statement, that they've been winding positions down as part of the exit. And obviously, if they were a market maker in this, in your small cap or any small caps you held, then obviously that has massively hit liquidity and driven the share price down in the short term. So what do you make of it? Do you think it's had an impact on some of these small cap stocks?
Well, we know that any liquidity pulled from the small caps has a massive impact. So yeah, could well have done, but the reverse should then happen, once they're out. So yeah, maybe that will be part of it. I mean, I think if there are good ideas out there and there are products, or not products, but there are companies that are massively undervalued, which we know there are, we could name numerous ones of them. I think 2025 has been like a patchy thing where we've had some really good successes and we've had some failures. But in general, things have been moving in the right direction. I think 2026 is going to be probably more of the same, but maybe even more that the whole market will go up, not just a few. Because this is the norm in the small caps. You get a few highlights. And then, as you move into the second and third year of a bull run, which is what we're in terms of resources for sure, then you get everything moving up and it will move up aggressively as well.
Yeah,
I mean, when we
absolutely.
look at things like Bazant, Extract, I know I'm a broken record in terms of these, but they are worth much more than the current market cap. I've been in contact with Charles. So when the article, what he's produced another article for, because that's going to be coming out in and around the meeting, which I think is on Monday, is it? So we're going to try and get that out then, so people can see the actual physical maths of what it's all about and why there is no way on earth it should be worth what it is now. It should be worth three times what it is now. And then as the stuff comes out, another three times over the
Yeah.
next period of time. So
Yeah,
yeah,
absolutely.
what do you make of the BSFA news that we got this week?
Yeah, I didn't really see much. I saw that there was a proposed equity fundraise and a change or a strategic direction change, but just tell us a little bit more as what you make of that.
Yeah, it's basically the same guys that went into Met One and into Mast. They've done basically the same thing. 15 million pounds, reduced the number of shares in issue, and then subsequently moved 5 million prepaid warrants at probably 10% of the current market cap, and then a load more if they can. What it does do for BSFA, it gives them a load of cash that they can actually use, which based on the technology and everything else, should do well. But yeah, it's the same game basically. So if you're in for that game, get in it. If you're not in for that game, then don't. On another note, Mast looking very good now. down to the warrant price, nearly five point something. And I think we're going to see that do very, very well in 2026, because the warrants are finishing in, I think it's the 11th of January. And after that, then basically a term free.
Very good. US markets, obviously, we saw the S&P 500 and the Nasdaq Composite both edged up this week. Dow dipped slightly a little after a weak start to December, partly driven by softness in tech and crypto-linked stocks. Again, another piece I saw by Hamish McRae in The Eye talked about that the US economy may be heading for a recession, highlighted a few indicators supporting, obviously, one of the key signals was a sharp rise in US unemployment levels, and noted that job cuts have been significant this year, with around 50,000 roles reportedly eliminated due to AI-driven efficiencies. There was a weakness in house prices as well. So interesting. I mean, I know Charles has talked a lot about that, not only the bubble in the US bursting, but also a potential recession happening. Bitcoin slipped below 90,000 at the start of the week, but is currently around the 92,000. It dropped 5% in one day, which was its steepest single day fall in a month as risk aversion returned to markets. Obviously, the slide has fed into a broader cryptocurrency sell-off, weighing on crypto-linked stocks and dragging on investor sentiment. We've seen, Kev, in the UK, some of the strategy, you know, the Bitcoin strategy, Bitcoin treasury stocks have been smashed down. You know, Smarter Web's trading around, I think it's like the 42, 43 mark. It's well down, obviously, on any weakness of the Bitcoin price, but some of the analysts remain bullish longer term. JP Morgan recently forecast that Bitcoin could climb to $170,000 within 6 to 12 months if it trades more like a volatility adjusted gold. So what do you make of Bitcoin and the wider kind of like treasury plays?
Yeah, well, they're being valued. I mean, it all comes down to Master in the US, to be honest, because I think it's going to be if they do not continue to stay in the indexes, it could be a bit of a bloodbath, to be honest. And therefore, I think there's potential for a lot of weakness in Bitcoin. Now, the interesting thing is, if you had the ability to raise funds and buy Bitcoin at a much lower level, then you're going to be a winner. So the ability for any of them to raise money is going to be winner-winner chicken dinner, in my view. You know, you've got all of them have to have something else. So the reality is, you've got Coin with the yellow holdings and other things. You know, that's gone a bit quiet. We're going to hear more stuff from that. I'll have to try and speak to Malcolm over the next week or two. You've got the London Bitcoin Company, who's been saying they're increasing their mining ability for the Bitcoin. So I don't know. I don't think we're going to have the euphoria that we had in the summer anyway, let's be honest. I mean, I did think it would go again, but Bitcoin seems to have a few stumbling blocks, if you like, in front of it. Still a big fan of the Tau, which we've got Astrid Intelligence. We need to get those guys on now that they've taken over the subnet and they're going to be doing stuff there.
Yeah.
We've got the subnets in Tiger Alpha now, which was Tiger Royalties. Again, don't know what the hell's happening. They need to start speaking up. It's not good fun.
No,
but in anyway, we seem to be in a bit of a crypto winter, if you like.
Yeah.
So how long it will last, who knows? I think the Master thing has got to play itself out, to be honest with you, because that's 3% of the Bitcoin in the world. So about that, I mean, again, I'm no expert on crypto, but I think that's basically what needs to play out. What I am convinced of is that resource plays are going to have a hell of a run in the next 2 years, right? Keep buying that silver. I'm about to go and buy my silver over the weekend again for this month.
$58 currently at the moment. It tried to bust through 60, didn't quite make 60.
Tried to go through 60. Interestingly here, the price of silver in Egyptian pounds hasn't gone up very much because the Egyptian pound has got stronger against the US dollar. So, you know, it's an interesting play because, in my view, we're going to have a year next year where the dollar will depreciate. It will lose some of its value, and therefore the price of these things is going to be going up. Now, as a last resource thing that I want to say, have you seen the price of copper? It's an almost at an all-time high.
Yeah.
$5.43 a pound, which I think is around 11,500 per ton. So, you know, the likes of Bazant, the likes of Extract, who are going to be starting pulling it out of the ground very shortly. And the other one, which I'm hoping to get Leon on the podcast probably next week, is Jubilee. Its profits have gone up by 10, 15, 20% this year, this week, just on the increased price of copper.
Definitely.
So that is going to be an absolute bruiser of a one to go up. And yet the share price is not doing anything.
No, I agree. I mean, copper is absolutely, it's riding high. I mean, all of these are pretty much on a week by week basis for the last month are going through all-time highs and pushing through every week, reaching new all-time highs, even gold, silver, copper, antimony. Amazing performance.
Tungsten as well with GMAT.
Tungsten as well. And there literally has not been any real re-rate in any of the stocks that, you know, you talked about, especially in this junior mining space. Jubilee, as you say, focusing on the operations in Zambia, you know, pushing on ahead there. Obviously, you've got all the Colin Bird companies that we've mentioned, Bazant, the Galileos, the Extracts, you know.
African Pioneer as well.
African Pioneer, you know, what point does Bushranger become? I mean, it already is economic, but, you know, will that be turned on? Let's hope so in the future, because that's a massive, you know, 1.4 million tons of copper there. Yeah, lots
yeah,
of
I mean, if this steadies out, Bushranger becomes in play, doesn't it? It's payable.
The one I want to talk about, though, as well, just moving away from the mining sector, is Solvonis Therapeutics, who in the week had a great RNS that talked about their novel compound SVN-015 being accepted into the US NIDA-funded addiction treatment discovery program for methamphetamine and cocaine addiction. And obviously, this is a big endorsement from the, as I say, the NIDA, the US National Institute of Health are going to fund and conduct early preclinical evaluation of this SVN-015. So really exciting news. The share price is up a little bit on the week. I mean, it's, I think it's up 8% on Friday to the 0.27 levels. It was around 0.23, 0.24 early in the week. It should have moved, in my opinion, much higher on this news, because this is the second drug candidate in their library, which has been pulled out through this AI technology that they're using. And I think that it could be game-changing.
Yeah. Well, we caught up with Anthony this week. So here's just a few clips of some of the things he said about Solvonis.
Big news from Solvonis Therapeutics this morning as well. Their AI-discovered addiction candidate, SVN-015, has been accepted into the US NIDA Addiction Treatment Discovery Program. That means the National Institute of Health will now fund and run the early preclinical safety work. And if the data stacks up, Solvonis could qualify for up to $3 million a year in non-dilutive funding to push the drug towards human trials. Crucially, this is targeting methamphetamine and cocaine addiction, areas with huge unmet need and no approved drug treatments. Anthony, when you look at the scale of the addiction problem and the fact that there are still no licensed medications for these stimulants, how significant is this step for Solvonis and for SVN-015's commercial pathway?
I think this is hugely significant for us, Phil, for three reasons. Reason one is it validates what we're doing in our drug discovery program, where we're seeking to develop fully novel compounds to treat high burden CNS disorders. So what does high burden CNS disorders mean? It means diseases with a large addressable market, so affecting many millions of people in the markets we're interested in, and high burden because there's currently a very poor or no current standard of care. So that's exactly what we're looking to do, targeting stimulant use disorder, methamphetamine and cocaine, where there are no, as you said, no licensed medicines. So this really validates what we're doing. Second reason that it's really important for us, it's, as you mentioned, it's non-dilutive financing, right? We are on now a pathway with one of the largest funders of healthcare research in the world, the NIH, and its subsidiary NIDA, the National Institute for Drug Addiction in the US, for one of their treatment tracks or one of their drug discovery tracks. They're fully funding and conducting an initial work package where SVN-015 will be tested for cardio or heart risk. If we pass through that stage gate, then we move into animal efficacy models, again, which they fully fund and which they conduct. We own all the IP, but they do the work and they fund the work fully non-dilutive, and then really helpfully for us, if we pass through those two work packages successfully, we would be in line to apply for the U3 G3 NIH grant, which provides up to $3 million a year for up to 5 years, aiming to take you from where you step off into the completion of a phase one human trial. So for a company of our size to be able to access that level of funding in a non-dilutive manner is really, really good. And then the third thing is, it's just, this is a stamp of approval and validation from, as I said, the biggest funder of healthcare research globally, NIH, and its subsidiary NIDA. So three reasons why this is important. It supports our strategy, validates what we're doing in novel drug discovery, and provides us with cutting edge access to cutting edge leading non-dilutive financing.
Yeah, absolutely. The SVN-015 is now, I believe, the second AI design molecule from Solvanis to gain this external validation. Do you see this as early proof that your discovery engine can repeatedly generate clinically viable drug candidates?
We do, but that's from sitting here. You know, what we've done, the first program to come out of that drug discovery engine was what we're calling SVN-SDN-14, targeting at trauma-related mental health disorders, starting off with post-traumatic stress disorder. And we are in the final stages now of candidate selection for that series. And we would hope through the course, or we plan through the course of Q1 next year, to have a lead candidate identified and then seek to progress that candidate forward into IND enabling studies and ultimately in due course into human. So that was the first series, and in due course will be the first drug candidate coming out of our AI discovery program. And now SVN-015, that's our second candidate coming out of this drug discovery engine. And for this one, at this early stage, to be accepted by NIDA onto their discovery program, that certainly is, from my opinion, a great validation of what we're doing. And there are other things we are continuing to work on where we would hope our drug discovery program would provide an ongoing, repeatable addition to our pipeline depth across the three pillars we're looking at, which is addiction, psychiatry, and looking to explore opportunities in due course in urology.
So, Anthony, you've got quite the stable now of different products or potential drugs that are coming out. You've got a £16 million market capitalization. It seems like a silly question, but if you happen to be listed on the US stock market, how much do you think you could potentially be worth?
Well, what I can say is, look, if people should look at our peers, Compass, 700 odd million, MindMed, near a billion, Atai, north of a billion, Cybin, moving up fast, GH Research, I think they're 750 million. And then a very close peer of ours, Gilgamesh, were purchased for $1.2 billion by AbbVie towards the end of Q3, early Q4. So certainly it's quite interesting, the valuations that are available in the US. I'm actually heading over there next week to participate in the Lucid Capital Markets. So it's a tier two US New York investment bank. And we will be participating on various panels with those companies, MindMed, Cybin, et cetera. And it's really, really good for us. Professor David Nutt's giving the keynote. I'm on one panel, and our chairman, Dennis Purcell, is on another panel. So we're certainly cognizant of the value disparity, let's say the arbitrage opportunity that exists between us and companies listed on the NASDAQ or on the NYSE.
So as part of that trip that you're going on, then you're heading down to Mar-a-Lago as well? Or
I am, yeah. I'm in New York Wednesday, Thursday, and then heading into Florida on Friday. And then I have to put on the tuxedo.
You have to put on the red hat, mate.
Yeah. Put on the tuxedo, and I'm going to a dinner in Mar-a-Lago. I just received a notification. I believe the big guy will be in the building, but I don't imagine he'll be sitting at my table.
Very good. So, Professor David Nutt, the scenario here is how big a library. I'm not sure what the technical word is you call it, but how big a library and how many potential drugs could we be seeing even coming out of this over the next period of time?
Well, I think we've got some work going on at the moment to explore other candidates that we have identified in our drug discovery library. We will have announcements in Q1 on those. We need to complete some initial studies against some other indications before we'll have the data that will enable us to provide further information. But we are pleased with the depth of our library, and we continue to work and explore in other indications to hopefully have other candidates coming out through the course of Q1 and potentially Q2 next year.
Yeah, I mean, I look at this announcement today and it looks like a fantastic announcement. I mean, basically, you know, a inverted commas normal company would be having to shell out certainly £300,000-£500,000 initially to do the heart testing, and then subsequently another $3 million for the animal testing.
Correct.
Whereas there's a good chance you're not going to have to do that.
And we don't incur any costs for the initial cardio screening, and if that passes, then we won't incur any costs for the efficacy tests in animal models. And so that's really pleasing. That's, you know, somewhere between $3.5 and $5 million worth of research that we will own all the IP for, but we won't incur any of the costs around.
So at that point, if you manage to get to that point at, for the animal testing, is it then a selection process, or is it a pretty fait accompli that you will get funding to continue the process?
It's a competitive process to apply for the next stage of financing, the U3G3 grants, which are up to $3 million a year. But we would be at that stage, NIDA and NIH would be familiar with us, with the company, and they would obviously have a deep understanding of the data, but also the robustness and the quality of the data, given the fact that they would have conducted the research themselves. So whilst it is a competitive grant, we believe if we were successful at Stage Gate 1 and Stage Gate 2, we would be reasonably well set up to compete for those grants. But as I said, it is a competitive grant.
So there are other people, not just people who've gone through this process, competing at that stage as well?
Correct, there are.
Okay, very good, very good. Well, I mean, regardless of that, it puts another potential drug into the system that you have. You know, what are you most excited about going forward in terms of what's on the table with Sylvanus?
What I'm most excited about at the moment is the potential for us or a potential future partner to redesign and change how severe alcohol use disorder is treated in the UK and potentially the EU with our 001 asset. Second most exciting thing for me is the potential that our 002 asset could have in a much larger, much more valuable US market, where we're seeking to repurpose J&J's Spravato for the treatment of moderate to severe alcohol use disorder. Where we are with that right now is we met a meeting, pre-IND meeting with the FDA in Q4 2024. The agency agreed that once we establish the scientific bridge, hello dog or cat.
Well, we have a Siamese cat here now, which we're... This is Jonathan's
like son. Bond. You look like something out of a Bond.
What is it?
$1 billion.
$1 billion.
Yeah. So where we are at that is the agency said we could 505(b)(2) into J&J's package if we establish the scientific bridge. So we're working now in a capital efficient manner with WuXi in China to establish that scientific bridge. And we'd hope to have, it's been done across two work packages. Work package one, we'd hope to have completion in Q1. And depending upon the answer on that, we may be required to do a second work package. If not, we'd look to apply, submit an IND and apply for approval for a phase 2B trial in the US for moderate to severe alcohol use disorder. So we'll know more about that through the course of Q1. But what's really important here is if we are successful in this, we won't have to incur the multi-million dollars that J&J would have spent on their preclinical program, the many, many millions of dollars they would have spent on their phase 1 program, and we don't have to incur any costs for a phase 2A. So the agency is supportive of once the bridge is established, there's no further human data required before going into phase 2B. That's huge. And for a market that's 3 to 4 times larger than J&J's market for major depressive disorder and treatment-resistant depression, that's a big, big opportunity for a company of our size. And then I'm really excited about the news flow that will be produced by our drug discovery program across the 1-4 program for PTSD, the 1-5 program for methamphetamine and cocaine use disorder, and then the other stuff that we're working on as well. So there's three things that I'm really excited about, and the news flow and the news that's going to come out over the next while. whilst we also then focus on the capital market strategy, which is really about looking towards the US at the appropriate time.
Very good. All sounds very exciting. And as you said, those figures from the US in terms of those other companies that are valued at, what, 40, 50 times your current market capitalization. Do those companies have as many opportunities in the market as you guys currently do?
I'd say a tie has more. The tie is a big machine, but you know they've got very deep pockets. Actually, Dennis is on the same panel as the major shareholder in a tie, Christian Angermeyer, next week. But I'd say we're right up there with the others, with the GHs, with the MindMeds, with the Compasses, and with the Cybans. We're right up there. But I would say a tie are far ahead of everyone else.
Yeah, and with your AI system and. You know, Professor Nutt, I think you could soon be producing these things pretty regularly. Yeah, which would be phenomenal.
That's the plan, and you know, we continue to seek grant funding opportunities for the other preclinical assets that we're working on. And as we produce data for those, and as we are able to confirm that we have a right to apply for grant funding to progress certain assets for certain indications, we'll certainly keep investors and your audience updated.
So my last question is, how did you come across the fact that you could get a grant for this number 15?
That would be Professor David Nutt. He is one of the most experienced researchers in the area of psychiatry and addiction. And he is well known within NIH, NIDA, and also very importantly for us, another space that we're probably looking at, which is NIAAA, the National Institute for Alcoholism and Alcohol Addiction. So Dave would be well respected, well known and well respected in those fields.
So what you're saying is because of that, anything that's going to be coming out of that because of Professor Nutt, you've got a good chance of getting grant funding.
What I would say is the probability of securing grant funding is dependent upon the quality of the asset, but the ability to talk to the right people to get a decision efficiently and effectively is through the relationships that David has.
Yeah, but the reality is I presume David's not going to be producing rubbish in terms of trying to get things through. So
yeah, he's not going to make a phone call to someone and say, hey, if it's not good. But the good thing with Dave is we'll know that the asset is good and then the phone will be picked up.
Yeah. Okay, great.
I think we've done it there. We'll say Anthony Tennyson, CEO of Solvonis Therapeutics, thanks very much for appearing back on the podcast.
Thanks, guys. Pleasure talking to you again this morning.
Okay, Kev. So anything else before we move on to talk a little bit about F1 and football?
Oh, really? Liverpool won a game. And we drew again.
Liverpool won a game, finally.
Yeah, flip me. Really? I don't think I've ever had a time like this in my entire life that we've lost as many games as we have.
Well, it was 71 years of the worst run.
Well,
so, yeah, and you're not 70.
That's true then, 57 years old, and I've never experienced this. So, I was glad we played West Ham. I didn't actually see the match against Sunderland. By all accounts, we played reasonably well. Wirtz finally got his first goal, but by all accounts, it's been taken away from him as an own goal.
Yes, I saw that.
Which is just bloody ridiculous, but anyway, such is life. He gets an assist, I think, instead of a goal, but he's getting closer. He's looking very good, I have to say. The big story is Salah's on the bench, and I think he deserves to be on the bench. He's not been good enough recently, but, you know, it doesn't mean he's done, because I'm quite sure he's not done, but, yeah. There's been talk that there's a bit of disquiet going on between some of the new arrivals and him, which is quite possible. And I'm thinking it's likely Isak, but we'll see. So there you go. So it was regarding football, what happened this week?
United drew last night at home against West Ham, so a bit of a shocker. And then obviously, you know, not a great result in the earlier in the week. But obviously Chelsea, did you see the shocker at Chelsea? They went up to Leeds and got beat.
Yeah,
but like, not just beat, but like, yeah, hammered. So that was a bit of a shocker. I don't think that was there was expecting that, but
Well, Manchester City have been scoring goals for fun, but conceding them for fun by the looks of things. What was it, 5-4 or something against Fulham?
yeah, it was that looked like quite the game, didn't it? Is it
Yeah.
5-4? Yeah, I think it was.
And
Yeah, 5-4 Fulham.
Arsenal keep cruising on. What's their lead now? It must be pretty good.
So in the tables, they've got their 33 points, and then City are 28. So they've got a good 5 point lead on there on City and Villa. I mean, Villa in third, mate, with 27 points. How well are Villa doing?
Yeah, we've got Villa against Arsenal at Villa
Yeah.
Saturday morning. Then, so we'll see how that one works out. We've got Bournemouth against Chelsea, Everton Forest, Manchester City against Sunderland. That could be an interesting
Leeds
one.
versus Liverpool.
Leeds versus Liverpool. So let's see whether they do the same to us as they did to Chelsea. Yeah, there was all sorts of things going on when I was in Liverpool. It was like people. And being sarcastic about Everton, after 4 days now, Everton were not ahead of us because they were all celebrating that they were above us in the league, even though we were both like 11th and 12th or something crazy. But to see Liverpool in ninth, the interesting thing is that we only need two more points to be in fourth. That's how tight it is in the league. And I can't see Arsenal not running away with it. It's, will they bottle it? I'll keep asking the question every week. Will Arsenal bottle the title is the question.
Yeah,
Because
massive
I don't think anybody else is consistent enough. The only one that I think could be consistent enough from here is Manchester City. And they don't look consistent. Chelsea, I think they're going to be there or thereabouts, but they're not going to be good enough for Arsenal. So anyway, on to the Grand Prix.
So yeah, very interesting. Obviously, we saw Max Verstappen win the Qatar Grand Prix last week, obviously capitalizing on a major strategic error by McLaren that cost both its drivers. The win has narrowed the championship gap and set up a tense three-way title. Piastri finished P2, position two in Qatar, and Lando obviously ended in fourth. And I think that was down, they did say that it was down to an ill-timed strategy call under a safety car. I think it was lap seven, and they're all down to when they pitted and change of tyres. But obviously Norris is still leading the standing. So have you seen what it means in terms of now how they have to finish? Have you looked at like the different positioning of what, in the final race? Obviously we got the final race at Abu Dhabi this weekend. We've just seen the practice results for Formula One. I don't know if you saw that, but Norris has basically pushed us slightly ahead of Max Verstappen. He just edged Verstappen in the practice session on the Friday. He finished like zero. I mean, listen to how close it was. 0.008 seconds ahead of Verstappen did Norris. So
No.
yeah, very interesting. But yeah, so basically, in terms of the final day this afternoon, you've got Norris at 408 points, and he needs a finish. He needs a top three finish, which will guarantee him the championship, regardless of where Verstappen or Piastri. So he has to finish in the top three. Verstappen must win the race and have Norris finish fourth or lower, or score 13 plus points more than Norris overall. And Piastri at 392 points, he needs to win the race, but he needs both rivals to score poorly, especially Norris finishing much lower, and he can overtake them in points or tiebreakers if the points tie on that. So loads of different scenarios there, Kev. It's all looking better, obviously, for Norris, but he needs a top three. He needs a pit podium finish.
So here's my question. Will the team focus on Norris to win?
See, I've
Because
had this, yeah, I've had this chat.
Piastri's chances now are 1 or 2%. Because the chances of the two like basically crashing out is what he needs. Minimal, right? Minimal. If they both crashed out, does he still need to win?
Yeah, I think he's got to get the win. He's got to get a top one, two, or three because it's Verstappen. So basically,
No,
imagine a
but
scenario.
if Verstappen and Norris crash out, 0 points, how many points does Piastri need to overtake them both?
So Piastri's on 392, and Norris is on 408.
So if both of the other two crash out, basically then Piastri needs to finish first or second.
Yeah.
So the issue is, if I was this team, I would want to win the championship.
Yeah.
100%. They've won the constructors already. So, no matter what happens, you've got to be saying to Piastri, you've got to help Norris win this title.
Yeah, but have you heard of Papaya rules?
No.
So Papaya rules, Papaya obviously being McLaren's colour, but McLaren have this real fairness thing whereby they won't like favour one driver. It's all about equality and all this lot. And that's one of the reasons why they reckon Papaya rules caused the problem in the last race, because it's all down to strategy. So I guess the question I've got on it is, if it was the same order as last race, where you got Verstappen, Piastri, and then like and Lando in fourth on the final like 10 laps of that race, right?
Even on the final lap.
But yeah, final lap. Would the team ring through, call through, you know, on the comms to Piastri and say, mate, you can't win this. Will you pull back and let Lando come through or whatever and let him commit?
Even if you drop back to two places, Lando Norris gets third and he wins the championship.
Exactly. That's the question I've got. But I think with Papaya rules, I just don't know if they throw it out the window and allow that to happen. I just don't know. But it's an interesting concept.
But for the team and the driver, that would be insane if they didn't do that.
Yeah, because it means we were saying this earlier. I was talking to someone and we were saying that the constructors, as you just alluded, like they've got that in the bag. But actually having one of their drivers win the championship is actually bigger for McLaren than it is.
The constructors doesn't mean anything. If your driver doesn't win. It's going to be very, very interesting.
And then we've got the cricket going on, Kev, as well. I don't know if you've seen any of the cricket. Did you see the second test we've got going on?
I haven't even looked at it. What's the scores?
So the live scores now are, let's have a quick look. Australia have just stretched the lead over England. A lot of drop chances there. But it's Australia are 377 for 6, leading by 43 runs. And obviously it's early days. It's the second day of the second test. So we've still got a good, you know, obviously second innings yet. But
the world is a-changing.
It is.
All I would say as a final thing is buy things that are real, buy things that are going to be needed for our economy. It was fascinating listening to Michael Jones today in Delta Gold Technologies. I mean, if there is a stock that I think me and you will be fighting over which one we recommend it for next year, it could well be Delta Gold Technologies, because I can't see that it won't have a significantly higher valuation than it does now. But, you know, let's wait and see.
Yeah. Okay, well, thanks for listening all. If you like what you've heard, please do subscribe, hit the bell icon, then you will receive notifications for any future episodes, and have a great weekend all.
Thanks for listening.
This podcast was brought to you by Roast PR Limited. If you would like to appear on a future episode of The Sunday Roast, please email admin@thesundayroast.net.